Hello and welcome to Malaria, Poverty and Politics. My name is Silas Majambere and I am very grateful that you have chosen to join me on this episode. Today I have the privilege to sit down with Anne Gasasira, a Ugandan trained medical doctor and epidemiologist. She started her career in malaria and HIV research in the early 2000s when HIV/AIDS was still ravaging the continent of Africa and malaria was becoming an increasing public health problem due to the widespread resistance to chloroquine. She worked on a research collaboration between Makerere University and the University of California, San Francisco on antimalarial drug efficacy and HIV-malaria interaction studies. Findings from this research informed shifts in antimalarial treatment policy in Uganda and wider sub-Saharan African countries. She later transitioned from structured research to work with malaria programs in order to support the uptake and utilization of data to inform programming and health decisions. Since 2015, she has been working with the African Leaders Malaria Alliance, ALMA, to support African ministries of health to implement data-driven management tools aimed at catalyzing progress towards national health goals through strengthening program oversight, accountability, action, and advocacy. In this episode, I chat with Anne on her career in malaria research, policy and implementation. We discuss the issues of agenda setting for malaria control in Africa. We talk about localization and the capacity of Africans and African institutions to tackle malaria. I hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome. Anne Gasasira, welcome to Malaria, Poverty and Politics. I'm very happy to have this opportunity to talk to you. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Silas. Thank you for inviting me. It's a great honor to be on the podcast and congratulations. It's a fantastic idea. Congratulations on thinking about it and executing it.
Thanks. Thank you very much. So it took a long time in the making. The thinking was longer than the execution, but I'm happy we're here finally. So, Anne, I have heard about you. We haven't had a chance to meet and to discuss and to chat about our lives. And the audience, some of them know you, some don't. So can you tell us who you are?
Okay, so I'm a Ugandan. I am from a family of, I have five siblings, so a family of six. I have a fantastic 11-year-old son. I've grown up mostly in Uganda. I've lived in the States bits and pieces. I've had on and off living in the States, mainly for school, but also partly for work. But most of my years have been in Uganda. What else? I grew up in a very Christian home, very Catholic, to be precise, environment. And I think that environment shaped me a lot. The Catholic upbringing, for those who don't know, is very structured, emphasizes quite a few things, values a lot. I also grew up in a family that was very cultural. My parents were among the generation, the first generation that left their villages and came into town. They were also highly influenced by missionaries, but they were the first of their generation to have education. So by virtue of that, our house was open to so many people from the village. We grew up in a house that was really always full, but at any one point we had, you know, quite a few visitors. So I think my upbringing, how my upbringing has shaped me is My parents' generation was also the generation that were political around the independence time and immediate post-independence. So within my family, I have quite a few relatives who were involved either directly or indirectly with politics around independence and the post-independence period. And the civil service made the first lot of civil service in post-independence Uganda. So all those things shaped me. And also the time I was growing up, there was barely a private sector, or at least I didn't know what the private sector was. So I was generally grew up knowing I was going to do service. I was going to work in a profession that really was service oriented. I was going to sort of work for my community, my country, to some extent. So that's the environment I grew up in. And then, of course, I think heavily influenced by my father, I became a medical doctor, and then subsequently an epidemiologist. So. Yeah, that's pretty much personal, I think. Yeah.
Thanks. That's a very rich life, and I'm glad we sort of have some things in common, as probably many Africans will do. The type of family, big family. We had a much bigger family. I have 12 siblings.
Oh, nice.
So Christian parents, Christian upbringing. So there are many things we have in common, and I'm glad to get to know you, and I hope we'll have an opportunity to know each other in the future. Right now we're talking on Zoom, so for people to know, I hope we'll have a time to meet in person and chat more about our lives. Can you tell us more what your journey has been in terms of career?
Okay. So first of all, how I ended up in malaria and then epidemiology more widely. I was in medical school, finishing medical school at the time when chloroquine was failing across Africa. And it was also the time when the HIV epidemic was really peaking. But also it was the time when research was beginning to have more presence in Africa. The research collaborations between northern universities or western universities and African universities. So my medical school was in Makerere University, which is the biggest public university in Uganda. And so there was a research presence around the time I was finishing medical school, both HIV and malaria. So as I was finishing my internship, my boss, the head of the ward I was working on, was involved in both HIV and malaria research. So one day he asked me if I knew how to use a computer. I, you know, had some basic knowledge. So I said, yeah, sure, I do. So he said, okay, are you interested in research? Are you interested in data? And I remember I was at clinical medicine. There's nothing like it. It's magical. But from the time I did biostatistics in my fourth year, I knew I wanted to do something more analytical. And I thought my talents would be better used in public health and statistics than as a clinician. So it was perfect. I was very lucky that, and the timing was perfect because I was just finishing medical school. So he employed me as a junior clinician in this really brand new research collaboration between the University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, and Makerere. And I was one of the first, I think I only found one other Ugandan clinician. But immediately I was drawn towards data and the analytics more than the clinical work. I did the clinical work better. So they trained me. My UCSF boss trained me in EpiInfo. It was long ago. And immediately I began sort of informal training in research methods and data analysis, and I absolutely loved it. I thought that's really what my talent was. And also, it was solving a very important problem. We were doing anti-malarial trials, so looking for the alternative to chloroquine. So I did research with the collaboration for the next sort of 10 years, I think. Yeah.
Okay. We will perhaps continue with your career and where you are today, but I wanted to interrupt a little bit and ask you a question. When this supervisor or collaborator came and asked you whether you knew how to use a computer, so there are two ways you can read this. And I hope we will read it in a positive way, but you can tell me what you think. Before I ask the question, back home when I was doing biology until the second year of the university, I hadn't touched a computer. So that's university, being at the university. I hadn't touched a computer. Second year of our school, we had to do biostatistics. Obviously, we needed to use a computer. And there were only two computers for 24 students. So obviously, two will be on the computer. The others will be standing around and just watching, not touching the keyboard or anything else. So the two ways I was thinking about, I was saying you can think about this is when people in general will assume that Africans don't know how to do a particular thing, and they could be right, but not understanding why that's the case. So that's one angle to look at. The second angle to look at is how at that age, university age, most of the people in the Western Hemisphere, Northern Hemisphere at that level would have mastered every type of computer at that time because they would have started much earlier. But you find yourself having to compete with them for a grant or for something else that you have to do. So I want to diverge a little bit into that because I've had those discussions with people before where my position is, or what I think is, an African scientist has to work maybe 10 times more to be on the same level of competition as a fellow same age northern scientist. What do you think about that?
It's the story of our life.
You can disagree if
really is the story of our lives. We have to work much harder. I think after we spoke, I was thinking about being an African, being a woman in a society that is very, what's the word, is it patriarchal or whatever, very male. And at some point wondering which was the bigger disadvantage. I get it. And I think in many rooms, you get into the room and you know you have to prove yourself. Even imposter syndrome, it's all related. It's good this one come up. Because you feel you don't know as much, you can't speak as well, you haven't read as much, you don't know computer, you know, it has defined us. And I think we are very resilient. We just move with this baggage. We don't even know it until sometimes we're told that this is not fair. Yeah. But to go back to the computer thing and many others, sometimes someone asks you a question and you have that thought process that you just talked about. They see you. I've learned the word for it: racial bias. Whether they know, conscious or unconscious, they just this person doesn't know how to use a computer. Some of them start teaching you how to use it. The ones who ask you if you've used it are nice. Others just try to teach you immediately how to use something you probably are decent to using. I think it's part of the racial biases or biases in general that we have to.
I needed to diverge a little bit into that because part of what I'm trying to do with this podcast is not to seek for people to be sorry about Africa or to how do you call that? I'm trying to get the right word. Self-pity. It's not about self-pity and saying that we're miserable and people don't like us or don't know how we need to suffer. It's much more to put the truth there and for people to know, so that when they are doing or they are collaborating with us as Africans or anyone who's involved in the same system as both of us have, know what we have had to put up with and also to work through and work hard on. It's not no one else's mistake. It's the countries we come from and countries are not equally developed in terms of technology. We might have other things we know well that others don't, but in terms of technology, we're certainly behind. So moving forward, so you have worked as an epidemiologist, as a clinician. You realized that you loved data analysis more. So how have you taken that forward? What are you busy doing now? Is it related or have you changed careers?
I have shifted my career. I think I still draw on my previous experience in research and to a lesser extent, but even now, a few months ago, I was at the Global Fund and we were talking about something and I remembered again the wards, the wards that I was in as a clinician looking at malaria. So all my experiences are still relevant and my skills. But yes, I shifted. By the way, while I was doing research, and I really want to emphasize the benefit of our collaborations between the North and Southern universities, I would never have gone to do a master's in public health or a PhD in epidemiology at the University of Berkeley, which is highly rated, if I wasn't lucky enough to work with this collaboration. And I got excellent support from both the UCSF collaborators and my supervisors in Berkeley. And really, it has shaped me. So at some point, we need to sit down and chronicle the benefits we have had. And when you invited me to this podcast, I told you again, for me, it's a responsibility to come and speak about these things, the good, bad, and ugly. There's been a lot of good, a lot of good. There is a lot that needs to change, but we must really celebrate our partnerships. So anyway, I moved to research. The problem I had with research, and I know you've been in research for a long time, is that it seemed too distant from practice and programs. The end game, quite frankly, is often publications and career advancement. And it's hard work. It teaches you a lot about working hard, being thorough. I loved the rigor of writing manuscripts, rewriting. It was perfect. But I hated it. It ended up in journals and not at the Ministry of Health. And of course, a lot influenced policy, especially the anti-malaria trials we did. But so much is just in you know, the Lancet, all those great publications, but too slow to reach where it should be reaching. And we're pricking these kids, we are doing all this, we're doing that. And I think we need to put more effort in publication to programs or to the bedside, as they say. I was a bit less happy over time with that line. And I moved then to surveillance, which was sentinel surveillance, which was closer to practice. And then that also led me to an excellent fellowship at the University of Washington, the Institute of Metrics and Evaluation, which taught me another set of skills, which actually after I finished the fellowship there in 2013, I felt I had the skill set I needed for a perfect career, which was really African-centered, supporting African countries from Africa, not necessarily from elsewhere, like Geneva, right? And then I was, again, very fortunate that I came across ALMA, the African Leaders Malaria Alliance, where I've been working for the last, I think it's now 7 years. It's a very African, a small organization, but very African-centered. It sort of amplifies the voice of African countries. It is set at heads of state level, and therefore it really represents Africa. Still, not perfectly, for reasons we can discuss later, but at least it tries to amplify Africa's voices.
Yeah. Thanks so much. I like the way your career has been moving, the way you describe it, from research and then going to surveillance and then you go into basically implementation with ALMA. The other thing that I really like, and once again, I see why, just for aside, the way I got to speak to you is through a friend who knows me very well and who knows you very well. And they thought, well, you should talk to Anne. I'm sure you'll be enjoying that discussion. And I am already, because there are parallels here to the way I've been feeling about most things. I was struck by what you said about research. I love research and I like the rigor, the trying to find something or discover something in the hope of helping out, solve a problem. But as you say, the way academic success is constructed is not so much about the end point of resolving that particular problem you're researching. It's about how many publications you're going to have at the end of the day. And as soon as that starts to kick in and you're chasing grants money, you sort of get distracted almost completely from that village where you come from. In our cases, the village where you come from, the people who are dying of malaria every day, that you remember that when you're writing the introduction to the grant, and then off you go, and you will remember again when you chase the money again. So it's not to say that people who are doing research are not doing what they need to be doing. They are, but some people will feel that this is not satisfying, then they will want to go. Others will, I mean, some people love pure science, not for the sake of curing a disease, but loving that, tracking the numbers and the data and then getting that p-value and having significance and publishing about it. And that's not a bad thing. People like different things. But in a place where we have a disease that is killing 600,000 people every year, it's understandable that you would feel frustrated and want to do something practical. Surveillance, one of them. And for me, it's not to challenge you, but I've worked with people who like to do surveillance as well, but I'm even more impatient than that. I feel like, okay, you're doing surveillance and then you know that your impact is good or bad, but then what? Then I want that last mile where people get into the field, boots on the ground, and then change things, or get to that hospital, cure people. But I know we can't all be doing the same thing. But one point that I, before I forget it, on celebrating the success and the partnerships, I think really thank you for bringing that up, because my tendency, and this is out of my frustration, personal frustrations, is to see the bad more than the good. And this is something I'm trying to correct, and thanks for bringing that up, because one thing that we have in common, if I hadn't met this particular woman, her name is Eleanor Michelle, she's an American, we met in Tanzania, I wouldn't have been where I am. She worked hard so that I could get a scholarship to study my master's in the Netherlands. Just single-handedly tried to get this done with all the problems of English and all that, because I come from Burundi, it's a French speaking, and there was that question, can he do a master's in English? And she just said to the committee that she knows that I will do it. So she just believed in me and pushed me, and then off I went. Then connected to another person, Steve Lindsay, who got me into the PhD, and it's just been them really supporting me. So I want to agree with you that there's a lot of good that is happening in these partnerships that help us get where we are. So thanks for reminding me to point that out. So okay, there's one thing you mentioned before we get into the politics of global health and funding. There's one thing that you mentioned, working as a woman, as an African woman in this space. How has that been? What is particular about being a woman and being an African woman in terms of career progression for you?
Well, I think it has been more challenging than I want to even think of. I think the way we have different ways of coping, and I try to ignore many things. But on reflection, first of all, I was never too conscious of being female until medical school, because this then is a scientist. Although I must say we were many females, but it's still dominated by men, and there's still a lot of I believe, and I might be wrong, but I believe there's an unconscious hierarchy: the professors, the male students, and then the female students. Somehow, this something about women again having to prove they belong more than men, right from medical school. While I was in my small research group, I think I didn't have that problem. But going out to conferences, it's just that you feel like less is expected of you, or than you. People will have questions, and they'll just be looking at the man. You're together, you are from the same collaboration, you have the same knowledge, but then questions are directed to your male counterpart. That happens a lot, both in Africa, actually maybe more in Africa than elsewhere. I think elsewhere we deal with the ratio, but again, once you come out here, you can't separate being black from being a woman, because you're a black woman. So you don't know what is at play, the color or the gender. But it's terrible, I think. And the higher you, the more senior you become, the more you need to talk about certain things, the more obvious it is, I think. Again, in my current assignments, when I'm out in the world, I really feel not respected enough unless someone else echoes what I have said. And if it's a white male, then it seems to weigh more than what I say. I'm not going to give specific examples, but
But do you see now I'm going to play a devil's advocate so that we just raise a few points here. There's been this movement, campaigns and awareness, raising awareness on the plight of women or Black women, Black people. But do you see progress? Do you see change coming? I've been asked that question, but I want to hear from you as a female, as a Black person. Do you see a reason for hoping that there is a change coming? And maybe your, I think you said you had a son. I don't know if you have a daughter, but daughters will have a better life than you have.
I think so. I think definitely, at least gender-wise, everyone is more conscious about it. And some of these cultures are very deeply ingrained in us. It will take time. But certainly, and in public health, there's a lot of females leaders. So certainly there's change. We can see it. More has to be done. I think the gender equality is moving faster than racial equality. Mm. So we have more leaders who are women. We have more opportunities, all of us that are female. We have more respect. We don't feel as, I think, the sexism is reducing, I think, broadly across. Mm.
We're now going to get into the depth of malaria politics and funding and things like that. So in general, first of all, before we get into details, how do you feel we are doing as malaria community if we stick to malaria only? Are you satisfied with the current progress? Do you feel we are on the right track? Or what's your feeling, personal feeling?
My personal feeling is we are not making much progress. We are stagnating, and we are, I don't know that we are addressing the things we need to address. We have ambitious goals, elimination in Africa by 2030. Mm. We continue to talk about it in 2023, yet we see the reversals across endemic Africa. Of course, I mean, you know the first chapter of any discussion about malaria. Since 2000, between 2000 and 2015, we made tremendous progress. We need to now talk much more about the stagnation that has happened since. And confront it. And personally, I think we need to reflect on what we tell our countries to do. We have countries like DRC, Nigeria, Uganda, and talking about elimination by 2030. And right from there, you wonder, is this the right message we should continue? Because isn't it really misleading countries? So I feel like there's a lot we need to reflect on as a community. I know that there's you have to, what is the saying, keep your eyes on the horizon but your feet on the ground. Mm. And balance in the long term and the immediate realities. And we should indeed continue to aim for elimination. But I don't know whether we're getting the balance right of keeping our feet on the ground and looking at the horizon. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. Well, at the risk of putting you in a difficult position, I did a response. I saw a tweet that came, it wasn't a tweet, a post on LinkedIn that came from, I believe it was from Alma, talking about malaria elimination 2030. And I was taken off guard a little bit because I hadn't remembered that we still are talking about 2030 at the time. And I just checked the global malaria report at the time that LinkedIn post came. And of course they were saying from 2020 we made progress and all that, but they did admit that For the past 7 years, we've had stagnation. So stagnation for 7 years, and then in front of us before 2030, we have exactly 7 years. So 7 years of stagnation, 600,000 people dying, and then 7 years, we're talking about elimination. So I did respond on that LinkedIn, but we're not going to dwell on that because it was published by your institution. So, but the point that I wanted to talk about, and that's the segue into my next question. So, who sets those targets? Like who sets the 20? So, I think Alma is talking about 2030. I think Gates Foundation talks about 2040. And there are other numbers, but are these the countries saying, looking at their programs, their budget, their staff, their interventions, and then calculating and then coming up with a number, or where do you know where these numbers come from?
I mean, to be honest, I don't know where that goal. I imagine that there was consensus in which, in theory, the endemic countries were involved in this, I believe, I don't know. But it is set indeed by a global community that where endemic countries don't have as big a voice as they need to. I think the funders, the you know, the big guys set the agenda. I believe the Global Fund released a strategy 2023, I think for the next 5 years, and I believe it still says 2030. I don't know I don't know what WHO says, but the last I looked at the Global Technical Strategy, I think 2030 was still, we're still using the 2030 milestone. The AU has a catalytic framework to end HIV, eliminate malaria, and so on. It's also still 2030. So what I don't know is how you reverse or how you change after you set a goal, and what's the, and who is involved. Yeah. I think at the time it was set, maybe it seemed feasible. I don't know. But clearly, when we're clearly off track, I don't know who decides that we need to rethink. Certainly the African governments are more of the receiving end of all these things, policies, and they just, you know, take up the WHO policies, which are not theirs, essentially. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, a perfect lead to the next point that I wanted to raise is who really sets the agenda for malaria control. So there's been discussions about agenda setting, localization, and having decisions made by countries. But we know, I mean, without mentioning anyone in names or any institutions, we know that this is not the case. Well, I know this is not the case. I don't want to speak for others. The agendas for how countries control malaria in Africa, control malaria, what interventions they use, what funding goes where. All those are questions that on paper, at least lately, major funders are saying, well, they'll be decided by countries. But I have been to one review for funding. I'm not gonna say the funder or the country, but I was in that room. I was invited as an expert reviewer to contribute on that proposal. And a particular person representing the funder took me aside during the break, tea break. And then this particular person told me very openly that if we remove one particular intervention from what the country had decided, then we will get that funding, or the country will get that funding if they removed that particular intervention and keep the rest. So unfortunately, I had advised that particular country to put in that intervention. So I had to be honest with this person and told them, I'm sorry, I'm not going to ask them to take it out because I believe they should be using that particular intervention. Lo and behold, that grant was not funded. And then in the end, they dropped that particular intervention and they got funding. So but this is a few years ago. So my hope is something has changed. But I'm not holding breath on that. So in your view, as much as you can say, and I know your position doesn't allow you to say everything you can say, but who do you think, or what's your comment basically on Agenda 13 and what happens in terms of interventions in countries?
Yeah. By the way, I must say that here I'm not representing ALMA. My view, personal ones, just to make that clear. So agenda setting is really not African. It is the agenda is set by northern countries, and I think for the most part they have good intentions, but obviously there are other agendas that come into the agenda setting. You can't sort of run away from the business interests in malaria. And although tools are designed to have impact, like we were talking about the end point of research and forgetting the people you're working for, eventually business takes over, I think, some of the agendas. Sometimes we have struggled with the discussion of bed nets. Are they working? Are they not working? But where the agenda is set, there's been some reluctance to look at some of the failures of bed nets. And then you see, you wonder how many lives have to be lost before this thing becomes so obvious that we need to change. In places where the lives are not being lost, it's not an urgency. And I don't know enough about global politics, but sometimes I see that some interventions need to be rethought, and it needs to be more of a bottom-up approach, thinking through things, and this takes too long. And I think if there's one thing that we can do to reshape the partnerships we have, it's to really let Africans speak and let those agendas be set in Africa, some of them. Just physically go and set the agenda in the places where the disease is happening the most. I think we can't talk in a lot of detail about this. These things are delicate, but I think that, again, on the going back to positives, the fact that there's this whole decolonization agenda, and there are all other sorts of other initiatives around decolonizing equity, and there's one called DREA, I've forgotten what it is. It's a good thing. It means that we are, and this is why probably we're talking today, because we feel we can talk because of decolonization and so on. There's so much to be done. We have a long way to go, but I think our voices will be heard more. I think Africa is being increasingly respected. I think Africa also is not doing enough to be respected.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. But just before I go to that, to echo what you just mentioned, we obviously, people should understand that the only reason we're bringing up the things that are not working is the urgency of the matter. It's because we're dealing with a disease that is robbing our continent of $12 billion every year in economy. And that's something that was, I think, published like 15 years ago or more. So it must be more than that. And here we're not talking about lives that we're losing. Like every child who dies is a potential that dies for the continent. So people shouldn't think that we're taking this against the West or the Northern Hemisphere. It's just that we're desperate for change and for quick gains and just stopping this problem in Africa. But at the same time, same breath, want to say, well, thank you to people who are putting in their own money. They don't have to give us money to do what we're doing. It's their money. So we do appreciate the efforts of different funders and what they're trying to do. The only issue there is we know that the current funding can do better than it is doing today. So it's, even if it was exactly the same amount of money, all the overheads that stay in the West, supporting the countries in the South, all the things that get paid that don't need to be paid, that's money that would have bought a particular intervention, but and somewhere else. So it's not to say people are not doing something. Funders are doing a lot, but that money can be used in a different way. So in terms of local ownership and what countries are doing, you ended your intervention saying that countries in Africa are not doing enough, which I totally agree with. Do we see why? So there's a theory that I heard, and I don't know, I want you to think about it. There's a theory I heard, and I believe I heard it on a podcast, a guy who was saying why countries in Africa are not investing a lot into, say, malaria, as an example. And he was like, well, I suppose you're a government in the South and you have 100 problems that you have to deal with. You have to pay the teachers, the doctors, the roads, you have to do a lot. And a particular funder comes and tells you, I'll deal with malaria. Just don't worry about that. I'll do it. And he was like, well, why would you even think about it again? You have so much on your plate and you have someone proposing to fund this particular disease, then you're hands off and you do something else, which I didn't feel was a good enough reason for countries in Africa to have to take their own responsibility. But what do you think is the reason countries in Africa are not doing as much as they should? I mean, the budget for health in Africa, most countries in Africa, is really, really small. Why do you think that's the reason?
So I think I'm going to be hard on Africa because that's Africa. I really think we are just not doing enough. The excuse that you just gave, it would be convincing if we were doing other things better. We're using our resources to, I mean, the health systems in many African countries, and I'll just be general, and I know that there are some countries that are doing much better than others. But you know, when we found ourselves with this pandemic and we had no vaccines, and it was terrible. And the argument was correct. How do you put Africa last? Well, but how much, Silas, have governments put into R&D? You hear President saying we must do our own vaccine. How much have they put in health? And health is a basic thing. I mean, if some say that if you put your money in the economy, in poverty, then people get better and health is improved. We haven't seen, I don't know where money is put in many African countries, but we always say we have the most resources and they're being stolen away from us. We let these things happen. I think that, I'm being tough. I think we are disadvantaged. I think the system is rigged against us. but we must do better. We must be disciplined. We must realize that this, no one is going to save us from our own problems except us. Mm. And everyone has a role to play, our governments, but also us, the so-called academicia or the elite or whatever, us who know, who have gone to school, who have seen better. We must push Africa to do better. I don't think we use ourselves as well. We know it. We don't have to talk about it. I saw a report of the wealth in Africa the other day. Extremely wealthy continent. We all know this. And there are exceptions where, like DRC, the system is rigged completely. But there are many other cases where we could be doing better, but we misuse our money. And until we show, and like you're saying, the money given to us from our partners, a lot of it stays in their countries. Yeah, even us, the money that we should be using on our communities, a lot of it stays in the hands of a few people. So I don't know. I think that many countries are progressing slowly, but many are also not waking up, and nobody's going to have problems.
Yeah, I agree. It's a sad thing that I don't always like to discuss because it depresses me, but as much as I'm pointing the fingers to the north, I should three fingers are pointed to me in the south, because there's so much that can be done within ourselves. But the point that I just wanted to comment on is the responsibility. One of the reasons I started this podcast is exactly that, is to raise or to shine a light on the African elite, so-called elite, and just to ask ourselves, what are we doing different? Because, okay, there is complaining about a system rigged against us, but are we helpless? Can't we do something? And I'm hoping that at the end, we will have a coalition of people who, like you and others that I'm talking to, who can get together and just think differently and decide differently. I know not everyone will want to support that, but there are good souls out there who might want to support something that is good, even in countries. If we start talking, politics are very difficult in Africa and elsewhere, but there are people with a good heart and good will to do the right thing. So I want to encourage everyone who's listening and who's willing to do something good. Just don't feel that you're the only one. Don't feel like Prophet Elijah, that you're the only one left. No, we're many trying to do our best. So let's reunite efforts and initiatives and see where we get. So it's really nice to hear you say what you're saying. So we're getting close to the end. So I wanted to end this particular topic with another question. I've heard some funders say that they would like to send money directly to local institutions in Africa, what has been known as localization of funding. But they cite an issue of lack of capacity, countries or local institutions not being able to absorb big amounts of money. Is that a real issue, or is that an excuse in your view?
So I'm not really very knowledgeable about this particular issue, but I think that we have expertise across the continent. I don't believe that there's no capacity. I think one thing is, like, through podcasts like this, you can maybe mobilize the capacity. I think maybe we may not have mobilized ourselves. We don't know each other. We don't know. There's a rich tapestry of expertise across Africa. Maybe half of us are not there on the continent. But we are where we are. We are ready to go and work. I don't know about We have good institutions as well. I think our institutions are modernizing. So Africa is ready. Africans are ready to take up this, and I think there's really no lack of capacity. Maybe those who know, we need maybe a mechanism of mobilizing the capacity.
Yeah, you're right. So this is what I always say. It's not easy to pinpoint and say, okay, in DRC, this is where the capacity is. In Nigeria, this is where the capacity is. But my simplest answer to the lack of capacity for local organization to absorb money is to remind funders, well, those who say that, the countries in Africa are dealing with billions of dollars. It's not just malaria they are working on. They are working on several programs with several billions of dollars, and things are going. Obviously, there are issues. There are issues of corruption, mismanagement, and so on, and that happens everywhere. It's not,
yeah.
I think now the world knows that corruption happens everywhere. It's not an African endemic problem, as they usually call it. So amidst all that, there are other institutions, as you rightly put it, there are good institutions that are doing fantastic job, who are well-structured, and they do financing correctly, they are audited correctly. So I think an effort needs to be made on both sides, on the African side, but also on the funders side, to find the right partners to work with. And as you're saying, hopefully with this podcast, with other initiatives, we will get to have voices and know where the expertise is, and perhaps tap into that. Okay, so we've spent a lot of time on this. I don't know if you have any point you wanted to discuss before we get to the last point, to the last issue that I wanted to get to. Do you feel like there's some points we haven't discussed yet that would be of interest to people?
On the politics of global health?
Or anything else that you feel that we should discuss? Because it's been me asking you things, but yeah. You might have other things that you feel are important to discuss for the audience to be aware of.
No, I mean, nothing comes to mind. I mean, I think what we're saying here about malaria applies to health, but applies even beyond health. And I think, I don't know whether this is part of the next question, but we all need to define what our roles are getting to where we want to be. Where do we want to be? And what is everyone's, each stakeholder group, the academics, the governments, and everyone. I think we are ready as Africans. We are of a generation, you and I, that has benefited, that has got skills, and that is at that where we need to do more for our people. Right? So this it's a great time. It's a challenging time, but the opportunities are there. I don't know, funding. I don't know whether we've finished talking about funding and the funding landscape as it is narrows as we get all these new problems, pandemics, climate change, and so on. Naturally, development assistance for health is going to continue to decline. Malaria is suffering a lot just because of the shortfall in funding that the Global Fund, from the Global Fund last replenishment, and doing malaria business has become more expensive. So I don't know whether at some point you and your guests, us, will discuss funding in more depth. Where is the funding coming from? And as it dwindles, what's going to happen to malaria? I think it's a whole podcast in itself.
Yes. Well, thanks for the tips. I'm trying to find good health economists that can come on the podcast and discuss specifically just the issue of funding, because now I could be completely narrow in thinking or naive, but I don't always think that our issue mainly is funding. I think in my personal view, our issue is usually prioritization and knowing what is important. The reason I'm saying that, and this is just a recent example, just so you get my point. When COVID came, no one ever thought that countries could mobilize as much money as was mobilized for the vaccine, for masks, for all the things that happened. It's amazing. In a few months, money was just flowing. Now, there's so much that's being said about COVID and how it was managed and what was correct and not correct, what was even true or not true. But this is just an example to say, whenever a human being is scared or scared for their health, they find resources to get out of that. What I'm worried about is that malaria has become acceptable, or diseases that affect the poor, malaria being one of them, HIV, NTDs, and others, it's becoming more and more less. Well, it has probably never been a high priority. Some few countries put in some money, but I tell you, if you had malaria in the US or Europe coming back and killing people, we will get money to eliminate malaria. That's a given. So in other words, it's either we in Africa, our governments start looking at malaria as seriously as they should and put in the money and the priorities, and the West helps in that way, or we will keep saying that we didn't replenish global fund as we should. And I don't know if the politics around the global fund and what global fund is doing are necessarily the best. I don't know if the way we're mobilizing money for diseases of poverty is done correctly, but I don't have that expertise to stand on to criticize that. But all I can see is simple examples. A disease that attacks the West is resolved in a month or in a year max. A disease that's been killing people for decades and centuries in Africa is tolerated and we can put in a few billions. And well, again, it's not to be ungrateful to what is happening, but it's to say, I think the priority is not there. People are not as concerned as they are for other things.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, just the priorities are not going to change. It's going to remain the same. And even because African governments and the African elites are not as affected with malaria as people, poor people in Africa, it is not prioritized. So we have a challenge to really convince governments to take it seriously. And I hope that the health economists and so on can demonstrate to our governments that this loss of money, the economic impact of malaria, and we use that more to get funding from our own governments.
So I want to end on a positive note, so that we don't go home depressed. So I want to understand what keeps you going, what makes you hopeful. I mean, you've been in this business for a while and you can see a lot of things that are not working, but what keeps you going? What gives you hope?
I think what gives me hope, like we have said, is these initiatives coming up that are shining the light on these problems. I think getting our voices through these platforms to people who matter. I believe you're going to get a group of people talking together. We're getting to know each other. And even generally, the malaria landscape is changing. We may be not using resources very well, but we are recognizing, I think at all levels, the importance of the communities to define, to be part of the solutions. It's very hopeful. I work, even just this morning, I was looking at some data on what is called the community scorecard, where the communities are discussing their problems and finding community solutions, and at their level, taking matters into their own hands. We need to support them. We need to know more about this, you and I first, before we take this to our partners. I think Africa is developing with all its challenges. We are moving forward. There's a lot of technology that is going to help us. So the future is bright. I mean, there is a tunnel. There is a tunnel. We can see the light. So I think the onus is on us, you, me, and others, to use these opportunities well, and to reshape our partnerships. Our partners realize things need to be reshaped. We need people to walk the talk, and we'll get there.
Thanks, Anne. I can promise you I'll be part of the team that pushes for the changes, and I'm happy you'll be part of it. It's interesting that you just mentioned that, because I was talking yesterday to another friend that my wish and my hope is to be able, I don't know where the funding would come from, but if we could organize ourselves and meet somewhere as Africans, as people who are concerned about what's going on, and just deliberate and think and brainstorm and then come up with, like, have a workshop and then come up with suggestions on how we think things could be done differently. And I'm sure the partners will want to hear that. Some of them will not agree. But I think it's as you say, it's a responsibility we have. Part of it, and I said it before, part of doing this podcast is really trying to rally people, yourself, other people that I'm inviting here. And if you know someone who would be interested in this type of discussion and workshop and meeting and discussions, please let me know, and I'll be happy to talk with them, and then we can organize together. If you have money, you can fund it. If you don't, we look for the money, the funding together, and we can get somewhere in Africa and discuss our problems and try to find solutions to them.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
All right. Thanks, Anne. I wish you all the best in your work, and continue to push forward. And hopefully we'll get to see each other physically and chat more.
Thank you. It's been an honor and very interesting talking to you. And this, I believe this is the beginning of the future.
All right. Same here. Thanks, Anne.
All right. Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. That was Anne Gasasira, Senior Program Officer at the African Leaders Malaria Alliance, ALMA. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and please consider following this podcast on your favorite podcast player, on LinkedIn and on X at Malaria Politics. Until we chat again, love mercy, act justly, and walk humbly.